Thanks. Senator Shoemaker?
Thank you, Professor, for sharing some of your thoughts today with us. I got three questions. First of all, is any jurisdiction that you're aware of, either nationally or internationally, using a progressive property tax system? The more valuation you own, the higher your rate.
Oh, you mean a nominally progressive structure? That's generally not the case. Generally, the rates are not taxpayer dependent, not property value. The rates are usually uniform for a class. I will say I've appealed to the idea of implicit differences before, and those do show up in studies of the incidence of property taxes. But explicitly speaking, I'm not aware of rate structures that are explicitly progressive based on the value of the property or the income of the taxpayer, that sort of thing.
So that would be a new modern idea.
Maybe a modern
question. The question is that whether it's modern.
Yeah, it's modern.
Second question. We had a presenter at an earlier conference talk about the evils of sales tax on business inputs because the tax just got passed on and it was a hidden tax to the consumer in the end. But isn't the ownership of property, the ownership of a factory, the land under it, in fact, a business input? And doesn't that have the same evil associated with it as just putting a sales tax on other inputs? Tax on an input?
Well, it's different in its nature. I mean, what you're worried about with a sales tax is the pyramiding or cascading. I'm sure that's what John Meixel talked about. The pyramiding or cascading of the sales tax, where you get a tax on top of the tax on top of the tax. Now, that's within the sales tax system, so you get multiple levels of sales tax adding on top of themselves. Now, you're talking about a situation where you're taxing land and capital for a business, perhaps. You may also be subjecting that business to an income tax. There may be some sales tax as well. You're talking about multiple different kinds of taxes. And you've got to be careful about that as well. But it's fundamentally different from a single tax that pyramids on itself. All right. Your point's well taken that you've got to be concerned about the whole package of a tax system and how it affects taxpayers. Right? You've got to think about all the various taxes that apply to them. But what you don't want to do is have individual taxes that are cascading like the sales tax would be if you took away all of the exemptions for inputs and intermediate goods, where the effective tax rate would vary across industries and across taxpayers in a very arbitrary way, depending on how many stages of production there are, depending on how vertically integrated or disintegrated the firm was. And so we make a distinction in tax theory between a tax which pyramids or cascades on itself from the overall picture of a tax system that may apply several different types of tax to taxpayers.
But in that case, in the end, the consumer is paying the tax as opposed to the business, theoretically.
The consumer may pay a part of it. The shareholders may bear part of the burden. The input suppliers, the workers may bear part of the burden in the form of lower wages. I mean, these are the usual suspects, right? The customers, the input suppliers, the workers, the shareholders, they're all potentially being burdened to some extent by any tax you would apply to a business.
But that's true of sales tax, too. I mean, one of those usual suspects is going to pick up a tab for that, too.
Yeah, but you're with the scenario you're spinning out in terms of the sales tax with no exemptions, the real problem there is not so much the one of the incidence and burden, it's the one of cascading and pyramiding that gives you this arbitrary effective tax rate across industries and across firms. So it turns out to be a very arbitrary way in which to tax. I agree, ultimately, somebody's going to pay the tax, yes, of course, right? And it may be some of the same somebodies, But the incidence is going to be quite different, and the effect on the economy is going to be quite different, where you've got effective tax rates varying markedly across industry sectors. Then you set off a whole set of incentives for people to alter the way their businesses are structured and the way they conduct their businesses. That's very inefficient.
Third quick question, I'm interested in the kind of reaction on it. I found intriguing your capital view, the 30-year-old modern view of property taxes, that it's a general tax on land and capital. And the and capital part is, we're talking about a property tax, which brings me back probably 30 years to you know, an entire section of Georgetown Law School spent talking on the topic of what is property. When we say we're taxing it, what we seem to be taxing is capital associated with land. Why the distinction? Why do we tax capital associated with land and not property tax on capital?
Well, we're taxing the capital that is typically situated on the land, right? We're taxing property. In the old days, property taxes were much broader, right? We taxed a much broader class of capital. We taxed household furniture. There's a famous example of taxes on pianos in Lincoln, Nebraska, many, many years ago. And according to the assessor, there were a sum total of, I forget the number, two pianos in taxes. But everybody knew there were hundreds, right? And so we stopped taxing that kind of capital. Pianos are pretty mobile, and evasion is easy, and so on. We stopped taxing many forms of capital for administrative reasons, and we've ended up with a property tax that applies to real property primarily, and to a lesser extent, personal property, machinery and equipment that's not permanently affixed to the land. The states differ in the extent to which they actually tax that personal property. Some tax it to a greater extent. Some tax business inventories, and others don't. The problem with that kind of taxing, that kind of portion of your tax base is that it's highly mobile, right? You can load up the truck and move the inventory out before assessment day and bring it back the day after to evade the tax. So for administrative reasons, we've ended up with a tax that applies to land, to capital that's permanently affixed to the land, and to some extent to personal property that's related to that. And states in general are moving more and more away from taxing mobile forms of capital because they're highly mobile. The state's tax structure can actually encourage that capital to move out of the state, and then that hurts the state's economy. Capital is complementary with labor in producing outputs and helping the economy grow, right? And so the labor is more productive when the labor has capital to work with. And so you don't want to have a tax structure that encourages mobile capital to move out of your state, because that's going to have negative economic consequences for you. And so states have been moving in the direction of taxing mobile capital in lighter ways through their property tax systems, and to some extent through their corporate income tax systems, which you'll hear about this afternoon as well. There are lots of reasons why the property tax, as it's currently applied in most states, has ended up with an emphasis on real property, on land and structures that are permanently affixed to the land that are not very mobile.
Professor Anderson, I ask a lot of people, what was your income tax liability to the state of Nebraska last year in terms of dollars? And it's quite common they can't tell me. They can tell me how much money they may have gotten back in April, or how big a check they might have written in April. I can't imagine going to somebody and asking them how much they paid last year in sales taxes
right
for the year. But if I tax that I don't like.
It's everybody's favorite tax to hate.
Right.
Right? And that's true not only here but everywhere, that where property tax reliance is substantial. And part of the reason you put your finger on is that it's highly visible, right? In Nebraska, we pay our property taxes twice a year. So I can tell you exactly what I have to pay twice a year. It's easier now that I don't have to escrow my property taxes along with my house insurance. But most homeowners can tell you, even if they're forced to escrow payments for property taxes as well, they're highly visible and they're lumpy, right? So you've got to write a check twice a year to the county treasurer to pay your property taxes, and that makes them visible. The sales tax is a more regressive tax by most measures, and you would think there'd be a lot of opposition, and yet people hardly notice it when they make many, many transactions and there's a small payment in each. In fact, if we went to the way value-added taxes are administered in Europe, they wouldn't even see the tax itemized on their receipt, and that makes it even more invisible. I don't recommend that, but in any case, the visibility of the tax or the salience of the tax is an important issue. And of course, we could restructure the way property taxes are collected. Instead of having them lumpy with two payments a year, we could go to a different system. That cuts both ways. On the one hand, when people know exactly what they pay, they're more vigilant about the services that they may be getting from their local government units. They may be paying more attention then to what's happening in the local governments, schools especially. And that vigilance is something that historically we've valued here in Nebraska, right? We speak about it in that way. On the one hand, if you made it more invisible, maybe there'd be less opposition, but then maybe there'd be less engagement with local government units as well. So I think part of the reason people dislike the property tax is that it's so highly visible, it's lumpy, and if you're capital constrained, that is, if you have a hard time borrowing, in particular, if you're liquidity constrained, it may be hard to save throughout the year to make the payments. There are ways to deal with this, especially with elderly and others. Some states, will have mechanisms where people can have reverse mortgages. Elderly people can have a reverse mortgage specifically for the purpose of paying their property tax toward the end of their life, when they may not have much income, but they still owe property tax and they want to keep their property. A reverse mortgage mechanism may work. And some have advocated in those kinds of circumstances an alternative, which is state or local governments put a lien on the property and collect the tax once the estate is settled. So you don't have to dispossess people of their property late in life because of the lumpiness of the property tax and the fact that their incomes may not enable them to make those property tax payments readily. So those are some thoughts on the issue.
One other question, Dr. Anderson. You made the comment about local people get what they could pay for what they want. I looked at my property tax schedule, and there must have been five or six or seven items, and I thought the interesting thing was every one of those had a local board, mm-hmm. or had a board that I voted on,
right.
whether it was the county, the city, right. The school district, the ESU, the NRD, or whoever was getting my property taxes, I had a chance to vote on it. Is there a concern that if we go to more of a state funding
and that's what I alluded to earlier, one of the advantages of a property tax system that gives the local government unit the tax base and the ability to set the rates is that it aligns the desires of residents in that area with public services that are provided. And to the extent that you move away from that model, and perhaps for good reasons, because you want to carry on some kind of equalization or you want to provide aid to communities that have less by way of resources, you do move away from that direct alignment between the residents who are the local voters and their desires for local public services. And that's a balance you've got to strike in, as you think about both the politics and the economics of what's happening with local public finance.
Senator Sullivan?
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Dr. Anderson. My question has to do with the circuit breakers.
Yeah.
Can you tell us, in states that have implemented them, what they have done to offset the loss in revenue? And secondly, you indicated that obviously Nebraska does not use circuit breakers, but if so, you talk about it being considered along with several other mechanisms, and I'd like a little more explanation.
Yeah. So states that have circuit breakers, especially the pure or classical circuit breakers that like an income tax credit that provides relief if your property taxes are high relative to your income. So the ratio goes above some level, the circuit breaker trips, you get a credit on your income tax or just a check in the mail. Of course, in those cases, the state's got to fund the cost of the circuit breaker. And it's a state-funded mechanism. In recent years in Nebraska, we have put some amount of money, it's varied from year to year, into providing property tax relief, and yet we haven't designed that relief to be targeted in the way that a circuit breaker would. But that would be the advantage of a circuit breaker, is that you could take state relief dollars that way and target them more specifically. The second part of your question?
Had to do with, we don't currently use it, but you indicated if we were to consider it.
Yeah, take the big picture. That's the point. So we already have a classified property tax system. We treat ag differently. And here I have in mind, I have been asked in the recent past to think about an agricultural property tax circuit breaker. And I'm thinking, we've already got a classified system that treats agriculture differently. We've already got use value assessment around urban areas. And so what's the point of a third mechanism to provide property tax relief specifically for agriculture? Now, if you move out away from just the issue of agriculture and you're talking about property tax circuit breaker, then the bigger picture is, all right, we've already got a homestead exemption that's loosely tied to income, so think about that. You might want to replace your homestead exemption system with a circuit breaker. You wouldn't want to just add a circuit breaker on top of other relief mechanisms that already exist. So my caution there is, take the big picture, think about the ways in which you're already trying to meet this policy objective one way or another, and think about whether this might be a better mechanism that would replace other mechanisms. And don't just add another feature to the tax system.
Okay, Senator Hanson and Senator Mello. And
Dr. Anderson, just a quick question about comparable sales. Comparable sales on residential property, people's homes. How often should those be a new valuation come out to keep property taxes in line with everything else?
Oh, ideally, I'd like to see the revaluation done annually, right? Now, that means the cost of assessment is higher, and so some states go to a three-year reassessment cycle, so some have even longer reassessment cycles. But my general view is the closer to market value, the better. I realize people have asymmetric preferences on this. They like their assessments to lag on the way up, but they sure don't like it on the way down. When prices are falling, they want those assessments to be immediately adjusted. And so we've got to admit the fact that there's an asymmetric set of preferences among taxpayers here as well.
What would be the best way to go?
Pardon? Annual reassessments are the best policy in my view. This is an administrative issue, but it is more costly than less frequent reassessments.
Senator Mel and Senator Bowles.
Thank you, Chairman Hadley, and thank you, Dr. Anderson. This question doesn't really directly relate at all to property taxes, but it's my understanding, and I forgot the name of the report in my office, the research you've done in regards to various state tax rankings, such as the Tax Foundation's Business Climate Index, for example. Could you share with the committee a little background on the report you've done recently in regards to kind of the inner workings of those tax rankings and how they come about?
Yeah, I'll try to be brief. I wrote a paper last year and presented it at the national tax meetings in Washington, D.C. And what I was intending to do was to take some of the most popular rankings that are out there and decompose them, see what's actually in them. Whenever you look at a tax ranking, you've got to ask yourself, what are they measuring and how are they measuring it? Because then you've got some way of understanding what the ranking is telling you. So I was trying to decompose some of those rankings and see exactly what they were measuring and then look at the way in which it was being measured and ask whether that's, first of all, appropriate. So there are some rankings that are not particularly well done, and here I'm not pointing my finger at any of the ones you've named. You really got to ask what's being measured and how it's being measured to make sense of the ranking. I made my earlier comment about looking at small differences in rankings and said that you've got to be careful because they're just ordinal rankings from 1 to 50, and there may not be much difference between number 27 and number 25. In effect, they may be exactly the same, but the ordinal ranking makes them look like they're more different than they might actually be. So that issue is also relevant, but the real issue you want to get at when you're looking at measures of tax rates in particular with these rankings is you want some measure of the effective marginal tax rate, especially on things like new investments. What's the effective marginal tax rate on a new investment in a state? And many of the rankings don't give you that. What they give you is an average tax rate for all of the current taxpayers in the state, and that really doesn't tell you much at all about the incentive on the margin. So it's that kind of issue that I was focused on. Which of these rankings are really giving us measures like effective marginal tax rates on new investment? And there are some rankings that are more suited to that purpose than overall rankings that just that take the total in the state and divide by something like I did. My measures that show you property taxes as a share of income, these are average numbers. These are not marginal tax rates. It doesn't tell you what happens if personal income goes up by $1,000, what's the increase in tax, right? So it doesn't give you that kind of marginal measure. These are average measures. And so as you look at various rankings, as I'm sure you'll do through this whole process, ask yourself, what's being measured, how's it being measured, and how does that match up with the policy issue that we may be debating and using the tax ranking to try to inform us about.
Senator Bowles, and then we'll have one last question after that, Senator Campbell.
Thank you. You were discussing earlier sort of a presumed inevitability that the land valuation bubble will burst. Does that lead us to the idea that we should create an education trust fund or increase our cash reserves? Or is there a better way to deal with that presumed inevitability?
Well, let me be more careful about that. I didn't presume that there's a bubble that will burst. There may be a bubble. At this point, I would not push that idea too hard. Yet, you know, why are land values so high currently? And the fundamental reason is commodity prices are high, right? Now, why are commodity prices high? Well, especially with corn, you know, it's bound up not only with international demand for corn, exchange rates, our ability to export our agricultural products around the world, but it's also bound up with our ethanol policy, our alternative fuel policy, and so on. Now, Will that bubble burst?
Well,
will these policies change? It's not obvious that this is a bubble that will burst, you know, momentarily. It would take some combination of all of those policy issues to change. So I'd be cautious about saying there's a bubble and that it's going to burst imminently. I think there are some fundamental reasons why land prices are going up at a rapid rate and have been for the last several years. Now, you know, what is that? That for local governments, that means they've got much more property value all of a sudden. It would enable local governments to take the additional assessed valuation and roll back their rates and generate the same revenue. They could generate more revenue depending on how they adjust the rates. Right? I mean, this is the fundamental issue with property taxes that gets lost in a lot of the debate. Local government units have the ability to lower their rates whenever the assessed valuations go up. And if they do it proportionately, they can raise the same revenue that they had before with lower rates. And if they don't do that, if they don't reduce the rates proportionately, then we're back to Senator Hadley's question about all the local boards that set these rates and whether they're hearing from their constituents about whether they should take some kind of windfall by not rolling back the rates proportionately. I'll defer the question of an educational trust fund. That's an interesting idea. That would take, you know, you'd be setting aside for future some of the gains you've got currently. This is notoriously hard to do. I would just point to state rainy day funds as an example of exactly that kind of thing, where states find it hard in general to let large balances accumulate in their rainy day funds. And then the temptation, of course, is to reduce the size of the rainy day fund either by lowering taxes or by some other mechanism. And then when the rainy day comes, you don't have what you want. So if you're thinking about an educational trust fund, I would say think along the lines of a rainy day fund and think about how that mechanism has both worked and had its flaws. A lot of states found in the last recession that their rainy day funds were tapped out weren't as beneficial as they should have been.
Okay, one last question, Senator Campbell, then we'll...
Thank you, Senator Hadley. Dr. Anderson, not only do we pay attention to what happens to the property valuation and the assessment system in each of the counties, but as a state legislature, we should be looking at how does this work in county to county. Mm-hmm. Are there any systems that you've looked at across the United States that has a good way of making sure that we have a uniform equalization across the state, county to county, so they don't get out of whack? You know, there's some better mechanisms that we should be looking at.
Yeah, this is an area where the IAAO does a lot of work, the International Organization of Assessing Officers. They've done a lot of work on equalization mechanisms, and I would refer you to some of their reports on that sort of thing. Some states do it more effectively than others, and I think that's highly correlated with how important the intergovernmental transfers are in those states where it matters more. The example I gave earlier of the state school aid formula that depends on property value per pupil, the more of those kinds of mechanisms you've got, the more important it is that you've got equalization processes that make sure things are done in a relatively uniform way across your counties. You know, in the old days in Nebraska, that didn't matter at all. But it matters now, and that's because of the school aid formula, and so we should be paying careful attention.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Anderson. We appreciate it very much. With that, we will stop the hearing for this morning and start again at 1:30. Thank you.
Thank you.